Grey dust rolled over the kingdom. Pataclusp dragged himself upright and groped ahead, gingerly, until he walked into someone. He shuddered when he thought about the kind of people he'd seen walking around lately, but thought didn't come easily because something appeared to have hit him on the head recently.
Is that you, Dad?
Yes, said Pataclusp.
It's me, Dad.
I'm glad it's you, son.
Can you see anything?
No, it's all mist and fog.
Thank the gods for that. I thought it was me.
It is you, isn't it?
You said.
Yes, Dad.
Is your brother all right?
I've got him safe in my pocket, Dad.
Good, so long as nothing's happened to him. They inched forward, clambering over lumps of masonry they could barely see.
Something exploded, Dad, said 2B slowly. I think it was the pyramid.
Pataclusp rubbed the top of his head, where 2 tons of flying rock had come within a 1/16 of an inch of fitting him for one of his own pyramids.
It was that dodgy cement we bought from Mirko the Ephebian, I expect.
I think it was a bit worse than a moody lintel, Dad, said 2B. In fact, I think it was a lot worse.
It looked a bit, what's the name, a bit on the sandy side.
I think you should find somewhere to sit down, Dad, said 2B, as kindly as possible.
Here's 2A. Hang on to him.
He crept on alone, climbing over a slab of what felt very suspiciously like black marble. What he wanted, he decided, was a priest. They had to be useful for something, and this seemed the sort of time one might need one. For solace, or possibly, he felt obscurely, to beat their head in with a rock. What he found instead was someone on their hands and knees coughing. 2B helped him. It was definitely a him. He'd been briefly afraid it might be an it, and sat him on another lump of, yes, almost certainly marble.
"Are you a priest?" he said, fumbling in the rubble.
"I'm Dil, chief embalmer," the figure muttered.
"Pataclusp 2B, paracosmic architect,"
2B began, and then, suspecting that architects were not going to be too popular around here for a while, quickly corrected himself.
"I'm an engineer," he said. "Are you all right?"
"Don't know.
What happened?"
"I think the pyramid exploded," 2B volunteered.
"Are we dead?"
I shouldn't think so. You're walking and talking, after all."
Dil shivered.
"That's no guideline. Take it from me.
What's an engineer?"
A builder of aqueducts," said 2B quickly. "They're the coming thing, you know."
Dil stood up a little shakily.
He said, "I need a drink. Let's find the river."
They found Tepic first. He was clinging to a small truncated pyramid section that had made a moderate-sized crater when it landed.
"I know him," said 2B. "He's the lad who was on top of the pyramid. That's ridiculous. How could you survive that?"
"Why is there all corn sprouting out of it, too?" wondered Dil.
"I mean, perhaps there's some kind of effect if you're right in the centre of the flare or something," said 2B, thinking aloud. "A sort of calm area or something, like in the middle of a whirlpool."
He reached instinctively for his wax tablet, and then stopped himself. Man was never intended to understand things he meddled with.
"Is he dead?" he said.
"Don't look at me," said Dil, stepping back.
He'd been running through his mind the alternative occupations now open to him. Upholstery sounded attractive. At least chairs didn't get up and walk after you'd stuffed them. 2B bent over the body.
"Look what he's got in his hand," he said, gently bending back the fingers. "It's a piece of melted metal. What's he got that for?"
Tepic dreamed. He saw 7 fat cows and 7 thin cows, and one of them was riding a bicycle. He saw some camels singing, and the song straightened out the wrinkles in reality. He saw a finger right on the wall of a pyramid. "Going forth is easy, going back requires," continued on next wall. He walked around the pyramid where the finger continued. "An effort of will, because it is much harder. Thank you." Tepic considered this, and it occurred to him that there was one thing left to do which he had not done. He'd never known how to before, but now he could see that it was just numbers arranged in a special way. Everything that was magical was just a way of describing the world in words it couldn't ignore. He gave a grunt of effort. It was a brief moment of speed. Dil and 2B looked around as long shafts of light sparkled through the mists and dust, turning the landscape into old gold. And the sun came up. The sergeant cautiously opened the hatch in the horse's belly,
When the expected flurry of spears did not materialise, he ordered Auto-Q to let out the rope ladder, climbed down it, and looked across the chill morning desert. The new recruit followed him down and stood, hopping from one sandal to another, on sand that was nearly freezing now and would be frying by lunchtime. "There," said the sergeant, pointing. "See the Tortian lines, lad?"
"Looks like a row of wooden horses to me, sergeant," said Auto-Q. "The one on the end's on rockers."
"That'll be the officers. Those Tassortians must think we're simple." The sergeant stamped some life into his legs, took a few breaths of fresh air, and walked back to the ladder. "Come on, lad," he said.
"Why have we got to go back up there?"
The sergeant paused, his foot on a rope rung. "Use some common, laddie. They're not going to come and take our horses if they see us hanging around outside, are they? Stands to reason."
"You sure they're going to come, then?" said Auto-Q.
The sergeant frowned at him. "Look, soldier," he said, "anyone bloody stupid enough to think we're going to drag a lot of horses full of soldiers back to our city is certainly daft enough to drag ours all the way back to theirs. QED.
QED, Sarge?
It means get back up the bloody ladder, lad." Auto-Q saluted.
"Permission to be excused first, Sarge?"
"Excused what?"
"Excused, Sarge," said Auto-Q, a shade desperately. "I mean, it's a bit cramped in the horse, Sarge, if you know what I mean."
"You're going to have to learn a bit of willpower if you want to stay in the horse, soldiers, boy. You know that?"
"Yes, Sarge," said Auto-Q miserably.
"You got 1 minute."
"Thanks, Sarge."
When the hatch closed above him, Auto-Q sidled over to one of the horse's massive legs and put it to a use for which it wasn't originally intended. And it was while he was staring vaguely ahead, lost in that zen-like contemplation which occurs at moments like this, that there was a faint pop in the air, and an entire river valley opened up in front of him. It's not the sort of thing that ought to happen to a thoughtful lad, especially one who has to wash his own uniform. A breeze from the sea blew into the kingdom, hinting at, no, positively roaring suggestions of salt, shellfish, and sun-soaked tidelines. A few rather puzzled seabirds wheeled over the necropolis, where the wind scurried among the fallen masonry and covered with sand the memorials to ancient kings, and the birds said more with a simple bowel movement than Ozymandias ever managed to say. The wind had a cool, not unpleasant edge to it. The people out repairing the damage caused by the gods felt an urge to turn their faces towards it, as fish in a pond turn towards an influx of clear fresh water. No one worked in the necropolis. Most of the pyramids had blown their upper levels clean off, and stood smoking gently like recently extinct volcanoes. Here and there slabs of black marble littered the landscape. One of them had nearly decapitated a fine statue of Hat, the vulture-headed god. The ancestors had vanished. No one was volunteering to go and look for them. Around midday, a ship came up the Djel under full sail. It was a deceptive ship. It seemed to wallow like a fat and unprotected hippo, and it was only after watching it for some time that anyone would realize that it was also making remarkably fast progress. It dropped anchor outside the palace. After a while, it let down a dinghy. Tepic sat on the throne and watched the life of the kingdom reassemble itself like a smashed mirror that is put together again and reflects the same old light in new and unexpected ways. No one was quite sure on what basis he was on the throne, but no one else was at all keen on occupying it, and it was a relief to hear instructions issued in a clear, confident voice. It is amazing what people will obey if a clear and confident voice is used, and the kingdom was well used to a clear, confident voice. Besides, giving orders stopped him thinking about things, like, for example, what would happen next. But at least the gods had gone back to not existing again, which made it a whole lot easier to believe in them, and the grass didn't seem to be growing under his feet anymore. "Maybe I can put the kingdom together again," he thought. "But then, what can I do with it? If only we could find Dios. He always knew what to do. That was the main thing about him." A guard pushed his way through the milling throng of priests and nobles.
"Excuse me, your sire," he said. "There's a merchant to see you. He says it's urgent."
"Not now, man. There's representatives of the Tassortian and Ephebian armies coming to see me in an hour, and there's a great deal that's got to be done first. I can't go around seeing any salesman who happen to be passing. What's he selling, anyway?"
Carpets, your sire."
"Carpets?"
It was Chidder, grinning like half a watermelon, followed by several of the crew. He walked up the hall, staring around at the frescoes and hangings. Because it was Chidder, he was probably costing them out. By the time he reached the throne, he was drawing a double line under the total. "Nice place," he said, wrapping up thousands of years of architectural accumulation in a mere two syllables. "You'll never guess what happened. We just happened to be sailing along the coast, and suddenly there was this river. One minute cliffs, next minute river. There's a funny thing, I thought. Bet old Teppy's up there somewhere."
"Where's Petracci?"
"I knew you were complaining about the lack of the old home comforts, so we brought you this carpet."
"I said, where's Petracci?"
The crew moved aside, leaving a grinning Alphonse to cut the strings around the carpet and shake it out. It uncurled swiftly across the floor in a flurry of dust balls and moths, and eventually Petracci, who continued rolling until her head hit Tepic's boot. He helped her to her feet and tried to pick bits of fluff out of her hair as she swayed backwards and forwards. She ignored him and turned to Chidder, red with breathlessness and fury.
"I could have died in there," she shouted. "Lots of other things have, by the smell, and the heat."
"You said it worked the Queen what's-her-name, Ram Jam Hurrah, or whoever," said Chidder. "Don't blame me. At home a necklace or something is usually the thing."
"I bet she had a decent carpet," snapped Petracci. "Not something stuck in a bloody hold for 6 months."
"You're lucky we had one at all," said Chidder mildly. "It was your idea."
"Hm," said Petracci. She turned to Tepic. "Hello," she said. "This was meant to be a startling original surprise."
"It worked," said Tepic fervently. "It really worked." Chidder lay on a daybed on the palace's wide veranda, while three handmaidens took turns to peel grapes for him. A pitcher of beer stood cooling in the shade. He was grinning amiably. On a blanket nearby, Alphonse lay on his stomach, feeling extremely awkward. The mistress of the women had found out that in addition to the tattoos on his forearms, his back was a veritable illustrated history of exotic practices, and had brought the girls out to be educated. He winced occasionally as her pointer stabbed at items of particular interest, and stuffed his fingers firmly in his great scarred ears to shut out the giggles. At the far end of the veranda, given privacy by unspoken agreement, Tepic sat with Petracci. Things were not going well.
"Everything changed," he said. "I'm not going to be king."
"You are the king," she said. "You can't change things."
"I can. I can abdicate. It's very simple. If I'm not really the king, then I can go whenever I please. If I am the king, then the king's word is final, and I can abdicate. If we can change sex by decree, we can certainly change station. They can find a relative to do the job. I must have dozens."
"The job? Anyway, you said there was only your auntie."
Tepic frowned. Aunt Klep Ptah Re was not, on reflection, the kind of monarch a kingdom needed if it was going to make a fresh start. She had a number of stoutly held views on a variety of subjects, but most of them involved the flaying alive of people she disapproved of. This meant most people under the age of 35 to start with.
"Well, someone else, then," he said. "It shouldn't be difficult. We've always seemed to have more nobles than really necessary. We'll just have to find one who has the dream about cows."
"Oh, the one where there's fat cows and thin cows," said Petracci.
"Yes, it's sort of ancestral."
"It's a nuisance, I know that much. One of them's always grinning and playing a wimblehorn."
"It looks like a trombone to me," said Tepic.
"It's a ceremonial wimblehorn, if you look closely," she said.
"Well, I expect everyone sees it a bit differently. I don't think it matters."
He sighed and watched the unnamed unloading. It seemed to have more than the expected number of feather mattresses, and several of the people wandering bemusedly down the gangplank were holding toolboxes and lengths of pipe.
"I think you're going to find it difficult," said Petracci. "You can't say, 'All those who dream about cows, please step forward.' It'd give the game away."
"I can't just hang around until someone happens to mention it, can I? Be reasonable," he snapped. "How many people are likely to say, 'Hey, I had this funny dream about cows last night?' Apart from you, I mean."
They stared at one another.
"And she's my sister," said Tepic.
The priest nodded. It was left to Kumi to put it into words. He'd just spent 10 minutes going through the files with the mistress of the women.
Her mother was, your late father's favourite, he said. He took a great deal of interest in her upbringing, as you know, and, it would appear that, yes, she may be your aunt, of course. The concubines are never very good at paperwork, but most likely your sister. She looked at him with tear-filled eyes. That doesn't make any difference, does it? She whispered. Tepic stared at his feet. Yes, he said. I think it does, really. He looked up at her. But you can be queen, he added. He glared at the priests. Can't she? He stated firmly. The high priests looked at one another. Then they looked at Petrucci, who stood alone, her shoulders shaking. Small, palace-trained, used to taking orders. They looked at Kumi. She would be ideal, he said. There was a murmur of suddenly confident agreement. There you are, then, said Tepic, consolingly. She glared at him. He backed away. So, I'll be off, he said. I don't need to pack anything, it's all right. Just like that, she said. Is that all? Isn't there anything you're going to say? He hesitated halfway to the door. You could stay, he told himself. It wouldn't work, though. It'd end up a terrible mess. You'd probably end up splitting the kingdom between you. Just because fate throws you together doesn't mean fate's got it right. Anyway, you've been forth. Camels are more important than pyramids, he said slowly. It's something we should always remember. He ran for it while she was looking for something to throw. The sun reached the peak of noon without beetles, and Kumi hovered by the throne like Hat the vulture-headed god.
It will please your majesty to confirm my succession as high priest, he said.
What? Petrachi was sitting with her chin cupped in one hand. She waved the other hand at him.
Oh, yes, all right, fine. No trace has, alas, been found of Dios. We believe he was very close to the Great Pyramid when it, flared.
Petrachi stared into space.
You carry on, she said.
Kumi preened.
The formal coronation will take some time to arrange, he said, taking the golden mask. However, your graciousness will be pleased to wear the mask of authority now, for there is much formal business to be concluded.
She looked at the mask.
I'm not wearing that, she said flatly.
Kumi smiled.
Your majesty will be pleased to wear the mask of authority, he said.
No, said Petrachi. Kumi's smile crazed a little around the edges as he attempted to get to grips with this new concept. He was sure Dios had never had this trouble. He got over the problem by sidling round it. Sidling had stood him in good stead all his life. He wasn't going to desert it now. He put the mask down very carefully on a stool.
"It is the first hour," he said. "Your Majesty will wish to conduct the ritual of the Ibis, and then graciously grant an audience to the military commanders of the Tesortian and Ephebian armies. Both are seeking permission to cross the kingdom. Your Majesty will forbid this. At the second hour, there will..."
Petrachi sat drumming her fingers on the arms of the throne. Then she took a deep breath.
"I'm going to have a bath," she said.
Kumi rocked back and forth a bit.
"It is the first hour," he repeated, unable to think of anything else. "Your Majesty will wish to conduct..." "Kumi?"
"Yes, O noble queen?"
"Shut up!" "The ritual of the Ibis," Kumi moaned. "I'm sure you're capable of doing it yourself. You look like a man who does things himself, if ever I saw one," she added sourly. "The commanders of the Tesortian..." "Tell them," Petrachi began, and then paused. "Tell them," she repeated, "that they may both cross. Not one or the other, you understand? Both."
"But," Kumi's understanding managed at last to catch up with his ears,
"that means they'll end up on opposite sides."
"Good. And after that you can order some camels. There's a merchant in Ephib with a good stock. Check their teeth first. Oh, and then you can ask the captain of the unnamed to come and see me. He was explaining to me what a free port is."
"In your bath, O Queen?" said Kumi, weakly.
He couldn't help noticing now how her voice was changing with each sentence as the veneer of upbringing burned away under the blow-lamp of heredity.
"Nothing wrong with that," she snapped. "And see about plumbing. Apparently pipes are the thing."
"'For the ass's milk?' said Kumi, who was now totally lost in the desert. A less desiccated culture would have used the phrase at sea. "'Shut up, Kumi!'
"'Yes, O Queen,' said Kumi miserably.
He'd wanted changes. It was just that he'd wanted things to stay the same as well. The sun dropped to the horizon, entirely unaided. For some people it was turning out to be quite a good day. The reddened light lit up the three male members of the Pataclusp dynasty as they pored over plans for...
It's called a bridge, said 2B.
Is that like an aqueduct? Said Pataclusp.
In reverse, sort of thing, said 2B. The water goes underneath, we go over the top.
Oh, the king... the queen won't like that, said Pataclusp. The royal family's always been against chaining the holy river with dams and weirs and such like.
2B gave a triumphant grin.
She suggested it, he said. And she graciously went on to say, could we see to it there's places for people to stand and drop rocks on the crocodiles?
She said that.
Large, pointy rocks, she said.
My word, said Pataclusp. He turned to his other son.
You sure you're all right? He said.
Feeling fired, Dad, said 2A.
No, Pataclusp groped.
Headaches or anything?
Never felt better, said 2A.
Only you haven't asked about the cost, said Pataclusp. I thought perhaps you were still feeling ill.
The Queen has been pleased to ask me to have a look at the royal finances, said 2A. She said priests can't add up.
His recent experiences had left him with no ill effects other than a profitable tendency to think at right angles to everyone else, and he sat wreathed in smiles while his mind constructed tariff rates, docking fees, and a complex system of value-added tax, which would shortly give the merchant venturers of Ankh-Morpork a nasty shock. Pataclusp thought about all the miles of the virgin Dajel, totally unbridged. And there was plenty of dressed stone around now, millions of tons of the stuff. And you never knew, perhaps on some of those bridges there'd be room for a statue or two. He had the very thing. He put his arms around his son's shoulders.
"Lads," he said proudly, "it's looking really quantum."
The setting sun also shone on Dil and Gurn, although in this case it was by a roundabout route through the light well of the palace kitchens. They'd ended up there for no very obvious reason. It was just that it was so depressing in the embalming room, all alone. The kitchen staff worked around them, recognizing the air of impenetrable gloom that surrounded the two embalmers. It was never a very sociable job at the best of times, and embalmers didn't make friends easily. Anyway, there was a coronation feast to prepare. They sat amid the bustle, observing the future over a jug of beer.
"I expect," said Gurn, "that Gwalenda can have a word with her dad."
"That's it, boy," said Dil wearily. "There's a future there. People will always want garlic."
"Bloody boring stuff, garlic," said Gurn, with unusual ferocity. "And you don't get to meet people. That's what I liked about our job. Always new faces."
"No more pyramids," said Dil without rancour. "That's what she said. You've done a good job, Master Dil," she said, "but I'm going to drag this country kicking and screaming into the century of the fruit bat."
"Cobra," said Gurn.
"What?"
"It's the century of the cobra, not the fruit bat."
"Whatever," said Dil irritably.
He stared miserably into his mug. That was the trouble now, he reflected. You had to start remembering what century it was. He glared at a tray of canapes. That was the thing these days, everyone fiddling about. He picked up an olive and turned it over and over in his fingers.
"Can't say I'd feel the same about the old job, mind," said Gurn, draining the jug.
"But I bet you were proud, Master. Dil, I mean. You know, when all your stitching held up like that."
Dil, his eyes not leaving the olive, reached dreamily down to his belt and grasped one of his smaller knives for intricate jobs.
"I said you must have felt very sorry it was all over," said Gurn.
Dil swiveled around to get more light and breathed heavily as he concentrated.
"Still, you'll get over it," said Gurn. "The important thing is not to let it prey on your mind."
"Put this stone somewhere,"
said Dill.
Sorry?
Put this stone somewhere, said Dill. Gurn shrugged and took it out of his fingers.
Right, said Dill, his voice suddenly vibrant with purpose.
Now, pass me a piece of red pepper. And the sun shone on the delta, that little infinity of reed beds and mud banks where the Dajel was laying down the silt of the continent. Wading birds bobbed for food in the green maze of stems, and billions of zigzag midges danced over the brackish water. Here, at least, time had always passed, as the delta breathed twice daily the cold, fresh water of the tide. It was coming in now, the foam-crested cusp of it trickling between the reeds. Here and there, soaked and ancient bandages unwound, wriggled for a while like incredibly old snakes, and then, with the minimum of fuss, dissolved.
"This is most irregular."
"We're sorry. It's not our fault."
"How many of you are there?"
"More than 1,300, I'm afraid."
"Very well, then. Please form an orderly queue."
New Bastard was regarding his empty hay rack. It represented a subarray in the general cluster hay, containing arbitrary values between 0 and K. It didn't have any hay in it. It might, in fact, have a negative value of hay in it, but to the hungry stomach the difference between no hay and minus hay was not of particular interest. It didn't matter how he worked it out. The answer was always the same. It was an equation of classical simplicity. It had a certain clean elegance, which he was not currently in a position to admire. You Bastard felt ill-used and hard done by. There was nothing particularly unusual about this, however, since it is the normal state of mind for a camel. He knelt patiently while Tepic packed the saddlebags.
"We'll avoid Ephib," Tepic said, ostensibly to the camel. "We'll go up the end of the Circle Sea, perhaps to Quirm or over the Ramtops. There's all sorts of places. Maybe we'll even look for a few of those lost cities, eh? I expect you'd like that."
It's a mistake trying to cheer up camels. You may as well drop meringues into a black hole. The door at the far end of the stable swung open. It was a priest. He looked rather flustered. The priests had been doing a lot of unaccustomed running around today.
He began. "Her Majesty commands you not to leave the kingdom," he coughed. He said, "Is there a reply?"
Tepic considered.
"No," he said, "I don't think so."
"Shall I tell her that you will be attending on her presently, shall I?"
said the priest, hopefully.
"No."
"It's all very well for you to say," said the priest sourly, and slunk off.
He was replaced a few minutes later by Kumi, very red in the face.
"Her Majesty requests that you do not leave the kingdom," he said.
Tepic climbed onto you Bastard's back and tapped the camel lightly with a prod.
"She really means it," said Kumi.
"I'm sure she does.
She could have you thrown to the sacred crocodiles, you know."
"I haven't seen many of them around today. How are they?" said Tepic, and gave the camel another thump.
He rode out into the knife-edged daylight and along the packed earth streets, which time had turned into a surface harder than stone. They were thronged with people, and every single person ignored him. It was a marvellous feeling. He rode gently along the road to the border and did not stop until he was up in the escarpment, the valley spreading out behind him. A hot wind off the desert rattled the sephacia bushes as he tethered you Bastard in the shade, climbed a little further up the rocks and looked back. The valley was old, so old that you could believe it had existed first and had watched the rest of the world form around it. Tepic lay with his head on his arms. Of course it had made itself old. It had been gently stripping itself of futures for thousands of years. Now change was hitting it like the ground hitting an egg. Dimensions were probably more complicated than people thought. Probably so was time. Probably so were people, although people could be more predictable. He watched the column of dust rise outside the palace and work its way through the city, across the narrow patchwork of fields, disappear for a minute in a group of palm trees near the escarpment, and reappear at the foot of the slope. Long before he could see it, he knew there'd be a chariot somewhere in the cloud of sand. He slid back down the rocks and squatted patiently by the roadside. The chariot rattled by eventually, halted some way on, turned awkwardly in the narrow space and trundled back. "What will you do?" shouted Petracci, leaning over the rail. Tepic bowed. "And none of that," she snapped. "Don't you like being king?" She hesitated. "Yes," she said, "I do." "Of course you do," said Tepic. "It's in the blood. In the old days people would fight like tigers. Brothers against sisters, cousins against uncles. Dreadful. But you don't have to go. I need you."
"You've got advisers," said Tepic mildly.
"I didn't mean that," she snapped. "Anyway, there's only Kumi, and he's no good."
"You're lucky. I had Dios, and he was good. Kumi will be much better. You can learn a lot by not listening to what he has to say. You can go a long way with incompetent advisers. Besides, Chidda will help, I'm sure. He's full of ideas."
She coloured.
"He advanced a few when we were on the ship."
"There you are, then. I knew the two of you would get along like a house on fire."
Screams, flames, people running for safety.
"And you're going back to be an assassin, are you?" she sneered.
"I don't think so. I've inhumed a pyramid, a pantheon, and the entire old kingdom. It may be worth trying something else. By the way, you haven't been finding little green shoots springing up wherever you walk, have you?"
"No, what a stupid idea."
Tepic relaxed. It really was all over then. "Don't let the grass grow under your feet, that's the important thing," he said. "And you haven't seen any seagulls around?"
"There's lots of them today, or didn't you notice?"
"Yes. That's good, I think." You bastard watched them talk a little more. That peculiar trailing-off, desultory kind of conversation that two people of opposite sexes engage in when they have something else on their minds. It was much easier with camels, when the female merely had to check the male's methodology. Then they kissed in a fairly chaste fashion, insofar as camels are any judge. A decision was reached. You bastard lost interest at this point and decided to eat his lunch again. In the beginning, it was peaceful in the valley. The river, its banks as yet untamed, wandered languidly through thickets of rush and papyrus. Ibises waded in the shallows. In the deeps, hippos rose and sank slowly like pickled eggs. The only sound in the damp silence was the occasional plop of a fish or hiss of a crocodile. Dios lay in the mud for some time. He wasn't sure how he'd got there, or why half his robes were torn off and the other half scorched black. He dimly recalled a loud noise and a sensation of extreme speed, while at the same time he'd been standing still. Right at this moment he didn't want any answers. Answers implied questions, and questions never got anyone anywhere. Questions only spoiled things. The mud was cool and soothing, and he didn't need to know anything else for a while. The sun went down. Various nocturnal prowlers wandered near to Dios, and by some animal instinct decided that he certainly wasn't going to be worth all the trouble that would accrue from biting his legs off. The sun rose again. Herons honked. Mist, unspooled between the pools, was burned up as the sky turned from blue to new bronze. And time unrolled, in glorious uneventfulness for Dios, until an alien noise took the silence and did the equivalent of cutting it into small pieces with a rusty bread knife. It was a noise, in fact, like a donkey being chainsawed. As sounds went, it was to melody what a box full of dates is to high-performance motocross. Nevertheless, as other voices joined it, similar but different, in a variety of fractured keys and broken tones, the overall effect was curiously attractive. It had lure. It had pull. It had a strange suction. The noise reached a plateau, one pure note made of a succession of discordances, and then, for just the fraction of a second, the voices split away, each along a vector. There was a stirring of the air, a flickering of the sun. And a dozen camels appeared over the distant hills, skinny and dusty, running towards the water. Birds erupted from the reeds. Leftover saurians slid smoothly off the sandbanks. Within a minute the shore was a mass of churned mud as the knobbly-kneed creatures jostled nose-deep in the water. Dios sat up and saw his staff lying in the mud. It was a little scorched, but still intact, and he noticed what somehow had never been apparent before. Before? Had there been a before? There had certainly been a dream. Something like a dream. Each snake had its tail in its mouth.
Down the slope after the camels, his ragged family trailing behind him, was a small brown figure waving a camel prod. He looked hot and very bewildered. He looked, in fact, like someone in need of good advice and careful guidance. Dios's eyes turned back to the staff. It meant something very important, he knew. He couldn't remember what, though. All he could remember was that it was very heavy, yet at the same time hard to put down. Very hard to put down. Better not to pick it up, he thought. Perhaps just pick it up for a while, and go and explain about gods and why pyramids were so important. And then he could put it down afterwards, certainly. Sighing, pulling the remnants of his robes around him to give himself dignity, using the staff to steady himself, Dios went forth. That is the end of Pyramids. It was written by Terry Pratchett and read by Nigel Planer.
This has been an ISIS audiobooks production. Please write or phone on 01865 250333 for details of our extensive range of unabridged audiobooks.